You may have heard about it recently. The ex-vice president of the Law Society, Mr. Chia Boon Teck, got into a bit of trouble with what he posted online.
That's correct. So basically, Mr. Chia, he was called out over his comments about a rape victim. And the case actually involved a TikToker who was convicted of raping a woman which he met on a dating app.
Yeah.
Tinder, I believe. So Mr. Chia was basically criticized for his comments, which seemed to suggest that the victim had a part to play in what happened to her.
Yeah, we've probably heard this term before, victim blaming. But
yeah.
We're trying to break it down today. Even the Home Affairs Minister called him out, among other folks, who said he was engaging in victim blaming. So what exactly is it and why does it still happen? So Sugi, let's start with you. Explain to our listeners, what is victim blaming?
So victim blaming, very simply, is the what people do when they take, when a rape or some other form of sexual assault or abuse happens, when people turn around and start blaming or casting either fully or partial blame on the victim survivor for what happened.
So right? For instance, like, oh, what is this girl, what was she wearing at the time of the incident, for instance?
Exactly, Otali, exactly. What was she wearing? She went to his room, she sat on his bed, and all these things. So victim blaming is when you focus improperly and incorrectly on what the victim survivor did to contribute or cause the incident or the assault, as opposed to focusing on what the perpetrator did.
Right.
So first question will be, why? Why do people do that? What makes you do that? Because yes, if I were to leave my house door unlocked, and I get burgled, people are like, hey, you should have locked your door.
Yeah.
Or if I were to drive a red Ferrari, a beautiful red Ferrari, leave it on the side of the road, unlocked, keys in the in the door, right? Mm. Keys in the car, and I walk off and somebody steals it. Sure, people are going to say, hey, you should have been careful. But nobody even thinks to vilify, right, and cast terrible kinds of cross-examination on the victim survivor to say how wrong they were in driving a red Ferrari. Think of it akin to, why were you wearing that sexy dress?
Right.
Leaving the door unlocked, leaving the car, the keys in the car. Why were you sitting in a bar? Why did you go back to his room? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I have to say, I mean, like Mark, perhaps you can weigh in here, because it seems like Singapore has progressed in terms of our laws, protection laws. Mm-hmm. So for instance, like married women, right? Even if you're married and if your husband forces himself on you and you've said no, that's considered rape. Yep. I mean, the laws have tightened in with regards to that.
Yeah, I think recently there have been quite a few changes to the law, and I think specifically to protect victims, complainants in sexual assault, specifically for sexual assault. So I think the Minister for Law had already set out, I think, his own Facebook post, some of the measures that the ministry, that the government has been taking together with the courts to implement quite a fair bit of protection measures. So for example, in terms of cross-examination, what kind of questions can you ask, for example?
Yeah.
It's where sexual offences are concerned, you can't ask questions relating to the complainant's clothes or sexual behaviour unless you get permission from the judge.
But a lot of people will be saying, some of this doesn't make sense because the environment does sometimes contribute to the offence. You know what I mean? You go into a war zone, you get hurt, you can't come around and say, well, you know, how come I got hurt? But you were in a war zone to begin with, right? So explain to all our listeners why this is sort of different in that respect and why, you know, our environment cannot be held accountable to the offence that occurs later.
Yeah, so I think there is a line to be drawn between conducting a defence and victim blaming. And I think in the area of sexual offences is particularly sensitive because the effects on victims, if they are so found to be victims, is quite damaging, right? People are already afraid to report sexual offences.
Yeah.
And if they feel like they're going to get blamed, there's a lot of psychological trauma that is inflicted. The trial process in itself is also quite, it's not the most comfortable environment, let's just say. And so all of these things are more heightened, more sensitive when it comes to sexual offences. Not so much when you talk about robbery, for example. Okay. Or like
so because it's a sexual offence. So if your house was burgled and you left the door open, in court you can argue, well, you left the door open.
Actually, you can't. And that's the whole point.
Okay.
And that's the whole point. Even if I leave my door wide open and I walk out, anybody who walks in and steals my goods is still guilty of theft because it was not yours to begin with. Even if a woman or a victim, a survivor of sexual assault, let's say was carelessly allowed herself to get excessively drunk at a bar, follows a man back to his room. If she then still says no, or she falls asleep because she's drunk, has she given consent to sex? If she hasn't, there is no excuse or no way to read the fact that she decided to meet him because of through Tinder, or because she decided to get drunk at the bar, and because she followed him back to the room. None of this leads to consent.
So I'm curious to know, because it's always a bit of a he says, she says situation, right? I mean, then when you're presenting all of this, what does it take in order to meet that threshold to successfully mount a case?
Yeah, so I think one is the factual question of whether there was consent, right? So if he proves that there was consent, either expressly or impliedly through her actions, then that is a defense. There could also be there must be an intention to commit rape. And if he didn't have the intention, if he genuinely believed but was mistaken that she did consent, that also amounts to a defense. And I think that's where the...
That's a grey area. Yeah.
That's where the difficulty arises, because very few of these offences take place. The offender goes and he says, or the accused person goes and says, can we have sex? Right? Very rarely does that happen. Typically, it starts off at an environment where they meet. Let's say a club or a bar or even a dating app. They decide to meet. And then they go home and then things escalate from there. Right? And very rarely in those situations will the guy stop, think, can I have sex? Can I touch you here? Can I touch you there? Right? And touching doesn't necessarily equate to consent to sex.
For victims, right, of sexual assault, they don't immediately say, oh, you know, I feel like I have been hurt in any way. Sometimes it takes weeks or maybe a month for them to process. And also there is this shaming, right? You feel embarrassed whether, you know, should I mount this case or not? Does it make a difference, like the time frame of how long it takes for them to, you know, make a police report?
So actually, that's the whole point, right? The whole point is that there is no one way to be a victim survivor. There is no one way that a person does or should present themselves when they've been assaulted. And that is the critical piece of information which is forming part of the training that the criminal justice system is undergoing now, so that when police officers are conducting investigations, interrogations, when defense counsel and prosecution are examining a survivor on the stand, and when judges are listening to these cases, they are acutely aware of the fact that just because you didn't immediately report it as rape, just because you didn't go and tell somebody about it, does not necessarily mean it didn't happen, right? Because different people react in different ways, and that's the whole point about the psychology behind this.
So just to play devil's advocate for a bit, I mean, if I'm the perpetrator, you know, in that sense, and you have sex with someone, and then 3 weeks later she cries foul, then you're like, but on that night everything seemed fine, you know.
Or I mean, they might even continue texting each other, like they're still friends.
There was no reason for him to suspect she would then say this. So he feels, what's going on, right?
So it essentially always boils down to, was there consent when it happened? Was there consent? So that excellent example you gave, Mark, in your piece today about the taxi driver, right? And how he was acquitted of the crime because he was able to show what some of the sexual acts she undertook, which is, doesn't necessarily mean she agreed to sex, but there was the audio recording of what was happening in the background. So a judge looks at all of this and makes a decision based on the fullness of the facts and evidence put before him to decide whether on a beyond a reasonable doubt the accused did commit did commit the rape. And that's why when in this case of he said, she said, and Mark will correct me if I'm wrong, in those instances when the prosecution's only witness is the only evidence they have is the evidence of the survivor, then there's a very high bar to ensure that before you convict this person, you are certain that this that you are beyond a reasonable doubt convinced. And that is, you must be an unusually convincing witness. So the protections are there to make sure that an accused is convicted on proper testimony.
Yep.
But what has always been missing for the longest time, and I'm so pleased that recently in last year, Justice Vincent Hung and Chief Justice Menon both put forward such great judgments talking about why, what is rape, what are rape myths, what is victim blaming, and why under the law you shouldn't be doing that, and specifically which portion of the Evidence Act tells you that by and large, if you're going to victim blame, these stereotypes, rape myths, I would consider them as beyond the pale. But of course, you can show if in that particular instance it's relevant.
Sorry, what did you said?
Rape myths.
What are
rape myths?
Yeah.
So rape myths are these untrue beliefs people hold as to why a person was the survivor is at fault for.
So like, for instance, like I'm wearing my sexy clothes, you know, or going back to a guy's house, or just because I meet you on Tinder, for instance. So those are the dangers of the rape myths, and they would have far-reaching consequences.
So those are the stereotypes which lead to the rape myth, which is she was asking for it.
Yeah.
And from that, you move to, so she must have consented.
Yeah. But it's quite shocking there, you know, like even in a 2019 survey by a market research involving 1,000 Singaporeans, they said 45% of respondents polled agreed that women who wear revealing clothes should not complain if men make comments about their appearance. And this view is not just held by men, but by women as well.
Yes.
So it's still a very...
Is that different though? Because that's commenting on your appearance. Rape is an actual violation.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, that's true. So they are different, but it is on that trajectory, on that path of the kinds of beliefs that lead to the more heinous beliefs about rape myths.
Okay.
Right? If you think that somebody who is wearing a sexy outfit deserves it's free, fair game, you can comment about it. The next step is making those comments in court. The next step is then thinking that if you've worn those outfits, possibly you went on the date expecting to have sex, and probably you consented. You see how it's a slippery slope from there.
Okay, okay.
And it's also, it's not just like, you know, the regular folks talking about that. It's you talking about the police when they're doing investigations or whether it's the lawyers. So, I mean, Mark, like what's your experience like in terms of, you know, victim bullying or blaming?
Yeah, so I think the recent judgments from the High Court have clearly set out what is relevant and what is not relevant, right? So, for example, if you talk about a delay in reporting, I think, Steve, your example was, you know, 3 weeks later, woman comes back and says, I was sexually assaulted.
Yep.
What happens in between those 3 weeks becomes relevant. It doesn't mean that simply because it is delayed, therefore it is not true.
Mm.
But it could be one of two things. Mm. She can testify to the court to say, I was ashamed, I was afraid, I didn't want to subject myself to investigations.
Which so are real, valid.
These are real concerns, right? Mm-hmm. So because of that, I waited 3 weeks. In the end, for whatever reason, I saw a doctor, I consulted a friend, and they encouraged me to report. That is one type of path we can go down. The other could be because they were in a relationship, they were texting throughout this whole time, and then an argument blew up, for example, and then suddenly a report comes in. So the guy may come and say, look, actually we were still no indication, she was still comfortable with me, but something happened in between us, and then this allegation comes up. So there is that tension. What happens in that 3 weeks becomes very relevant.
So those factors will be taken into consideration as well.
In April 2023, the police actually formed the Sexual Crime and Family Violence Command to basically raise standards of investigations. And what are some of the differences you've seen or that you think have made a difference?
I think the purpose of setting up that command, and I think together with the One Stop, I think AWARE had a hand in it. It's because the investigative process is actually quite, can be quite traumatic for a victim of sexual assault. And just the fact of having to repeat your story many times makes you replay that scene in your mind, and then the police tells you, prosecution tells you, you must remember this, right? Because it's evidence. She is the sole witness, right? He said, she said. If she forgets, No one else knows what happened. So she first goes to the police, she records one statement. She goes to a counsellor, for example, she repeats it one more time. She goes to meet the prosecutor, she repeats it one more time. She goes to the stand, okay. She repeats it one more time, she gets cross-examined on it. So just this whole process can be quite
traumatic. Yeah.
And I think that was what the policy intent for that command and the one-stop center was for, to do the medical examination.
Because otherwise, if you're a victim, you're like, maybe it's better I just don't report and forget about it,
and
right?
And most people don't. I mean, just the thought of having to repeat my story so many times.
Exactly.
I mean, why, you know, and who's going to believe me? And again, all the rape myths and all of that comes into, right, into their victim's
heads. I also just want to throw on the flip side. We mustn't forget that men can also be raped.
Yes.
Right? And if we were to flip it around, actually, would we ask a guy, what were you wearing? How many buttons of your shirt did you have undone? You know what I mean? Right. So actually, it does then lend a different, slightly different perspective to the situation.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So men being rape victims, I think it's a more recent development because it required a change in the penal code, I believe, in 2020 to make it gender neutral.
Yeah.
Right. And previously, before 2020, men couldn't be raped. Right. Oh. In the sense that the way that the provision was was worded, only females could be victims of rape specifically.
Okay.
Mm. And so part of the penal code amendments, together with increasing some of the penalties for some sexual offences, was to make it gender neutral, such that men or boys, depending on their age, can be considered victims of rape.
How would you teach, you know, when, let's say, it seems obvious, right? When a girl says no, it should mean no.
But,
I know,
but
right?
Mark explained earlier, you're not going to go like, oh, by the way, are you okay to have sex? You know, after they've had a whole bunch of drinks and stuff like that.
Well, interestingly, this girl said no.
Okay.
She actually said no.
Yeah, so she said no without him even asking. But in some cases, things kind of just happen, right?
And I think that is quite common. I mean, at least where the contested cases come about. The girl doesn't say anything. Sometimes she goes on the stand and she says, "I froze," for example.
Yeah.
But from the accused perspective, nothing is said. He
implied consent. That's what
implies
he thinks.
It as consent. Yeah. And I mean, typically, if we think about some of the movies that we watched when we were younger, it starts off with the guy trying to chase a girl, for example. Mm. Girls play hard to get. So there is this idea that the man makes the first move, right? And what is the first move typically? He would try to initiate some contact, see the response, go a little bit further, see the response.
Okay.
And in the end, what transpires out of it, if it then comes back to him, he has no choice at trial but to start talking about all of these things, right? I touched her. She didn't say anything.
Oh, it's like I held her hand. She didn't pull her hand away, which meant she didn't mind holding my hand, right?
Yeah.
One would imagine,
Correct.
So this is a very difficult gray area, and absolutely right. And that's a great example, Mark, because those are the things that lean into the issues, right?
Okay.
That you have this sense of the expectation that boys make the first move. The expectation, therefore, that you should push the boundaries, and if you don't get pushback, it's okay. I think over time and as society is developing, what I think we need to recognize is that consent is not the same thing, or we cannot assume consent.
Mm.
Now, I understand this whole thing, and that's where the gray area will come. If she actually says no, it's no. If she actually says yes, it's yes. The gray area in between is where everyone's going to be in trouble.
Yep.
Mm. So actually, it really bears worth having conversations about this. How do you communicate these conversations? How do you talk about it so that, because it's I can see that from the point of view, like, hey, she didn't stop me, so why are you blaming me?
Mm.
From the other point, if she's really panicking, it's
her
first time,
right?
She's scared, she freezes,
is
it then okay because she then had sex against her will?
So for all of our listeners, you know, listening and watching this, what advice then, especially maybe Mark, for the guys who are then in these situations, how should they proceed?
The key thing is understanding what consent means.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? And that it is no longer a situation whereby you can do whatever you want. If there's no pushback, then all is good. I think there has to be quite a lot of sensitivity in terms of... And I think it also comes in together with recognition of, you know, gender equality, women's rights. Mm-hmm. When a woman says no, it means no. I mean, a lot of the joke that men used to make, especially husbands, is the wife says, no lah, I don't want. But if you take it at face value, you get scolded, right? Oh, do you want this bag? No lah, I don't want. Right? And then, why didn't you buy me this bag? Right?
What do you mean?
So we are getting to okay. that place where if she says no, it means no. You
just make yourself very clear.
Right. You don't try and push it, right? And I think the ongoing, and especially amongst legal professionals, we do need to be quite clear as to when we encounter these kinds of cases, to advise our clients what is relevant, what is really a no-go, right? Mm. If he says, but she did this, then part of our job as defense counsel is to tell him, but that is really not relevant in the scheme of things. Let's focus on what's important. I tell the guys, don't put yourself in that situation either, right?
Okay.
Don't put yourself in a situation where you want, you even start thinking about, okay, is this gonna happen? Mm. Should I try, right? Don't put yourself in that situation. And I think that, I mean, of course, it's easy to say, just don't engage in one night stands. Right. Don't go down that path.
But if you're really stuck there, just ask the girl.
Just ask.
Ask.
Are you okay?
Are you okay? Are you willing? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Can I go on? Shall I go on? Are you okay?
And your advice for women?
My advice for women would be that, look, you have to be aware of dangers in life. All of us have to be aware of dangers in life, right? And from the perspective of what happens to women when these things happen, you don't want all these unreasonable expectations on us. I am not going to tell women, hey, don't dress sexy. I'm not going to tell women, don't go to a bar and have a drink. We are not back in the dark ages.
Yep.
It took forever for women to come forward, to have a position and the ability to live their own lives. So that cannot be it. That really cannot be it. Right? It has to be about respect and it has to be about communicating what you want with each other. And that's why I say, again, the most important thing is really teaching everyone and starting with children and adolescents. How do you navigate these difficult situations? What does consent mean? Mm. How do you navigate that situation, read the signs, ask each other respectfully, and how do you then figure out what is okay and what is not okay?
Yep.
Because if we don't teach children when they're young and we don't teach adolescents when they're young how to navigate these difficult situations, how are they going to know it when they're older?
That's right. Yeah.
Well, thank you so very much. I think we've gained quite a few tips and points today.
That's right. So for all of you who are listening in, I mean, it's a tough topic, and I think that there's no clear black and white answer, so to speak, you know, but when in doubt, don't.
Yeah, just be clear. Just keep talking, right? Keep the conversations going, yeah.
So don't drink so much so that you cannot talk anymore, you know.
That's not often
the problem. All right, guys. Thanks so much for joining us on Deep Dive. As usual, if you have any thoughts, comments, shoot us a note. We do love to hear from you. But otherwise, a shout out to the team, Tiffany Ang, Janani Johari, Joanne Chan, Sayewin, and Hanida Amin. That's it for Deep Dive.
See you next week.